Suitors and claimants circled the throne like wolves in early winter, still wary enough to remain at a distance, but with growing hunger. Most ambitious of the pack was no wolf but a lion, the lioness of Azal. Though I never met Lionette de la Courcelle de Trevelyan in all this time, I heard much of her and her constant intrigues. One I even learnt of first hand. I had been contracted for a 2-day assignation to the Marquise Solène Belfort at her country estate. Delaunay had picked his target well in her. It was her pleasure to assign me tasks I had no hope of completing, and chastise me for the failure. On this occasion she led me to her receiving room, where she had ordered the gardeners to deliver a burgeoning pile of cut flowers. They sprawled in a mound on the sideboard, a profusion of blossoms and tangled stems, dripping onto the wood and shedding dirt and leaves. "I'm going for a ride," she informed me with her customary arrogance. "When I return, I wish to have a glass of cordial in this room, and I wish it to be in proper array, and you in waiting attendance. Is that clear, Phaedra?" I despise being forced to perform menial work, which Solène Belfort had somehow discerned. Women are cleverer than men at such things, on the whole. I dreaded these assignations, except for the fact that she was splendid in her anger. So it was that I cursed and swore through the better part of an hour, separating stems and pricking my fingers as I shoved roses, asters, and zinnia into various vessels. Her servants brought buckets of water and a dustpan and rags and wax for the sideboard, but would not aid me in any way, being forbidden to do so. I do not know if the country servants gossip as they do in the city, but of a surety these had no illusion about why I was there. Of course it was not possible to complete the chore in the allotted time, and Solène Belfort strode through the door still in riding attire while I was just beginning to brush dirt into the dustpan. I knelt quickly, but she was faster with her riding crop, catching me across the shoulders. "Wretched slattern! I told you to have this room ready for me! What do you call this?" Sweeping one hand through the mess of water and dirt on the sideboard, she peeled off her glove and struck me in the face with it. I tossed my hair back and glared at her, not needing to feign sullenness. "You ask too much," I retorted. Solène Belfort had blue-green eyes, the colour of aquamarines. When she was angry they indeed turned as cold and hard as gemstones. It made my breath come quicker to watch it. "I ask only to be well served," she said coolly. She took her crop in her bare hand, tapping it against the gloved palm of the other. "And you presume too much. Take off your dress." It was not my first time with her, and I knew how the scene played out. It is a strange thing, this playing and not playing. That my role was scripted to meet her desires, I knew well, and played it accordingly. But there was no artifice in it, when the crop stung my bare flesh over and over, and I pleaded with her to let me make amends. There is a certain victory in it when they surrender. Much as I despised her, I trembled as she allowed me to perform an act of contrition, undoing the buttons of her riding breeches, pressing my mouth against her heated flesh. I closed my eyes as her hands came to rest on my head, the now idle crop held loosely, gently brushing my back and reminding me of its cruelties. And it was at this moment that her steward intruded, entering with averted eyes to announce the arrival of a courier with an urgent message from Lionette de Trevelyan. "Blessed Eloa!" There was mingled annoyance and alarm in her voice. "What does she want now? Show him in!" Stepping away from me, Solène Belfort refastened her riding attire and smoothed her hair. I remained as I was, kneeling. She cast a glance at me, all annoyance now. "I am not finished with you. Put your clothes on and attend." Of a surety I did not need to be told twice. I had learned in Sirius House how to be unobtrusive, and I had learned the value of it from Delaunay. I knelt abeyant, quiet and nigh invisible, as the lioness of Azal's courier entered. I do not know what he looked like. Delaunay might chide me for it, but I dared not raise my eyes. It was to my good fortune that the Marquise, like many people, could not read without murmuring the words aloud to herself. I can, and so can Alcuin, but only because Delaunay made us learn to do so. Solène Belfort could not, and thus did I learn of Lionette de Trevelyan's request. It was rumoured that the Caliph of Kerbel-im-Arkad had proposed an alliance between our countries, with a marriage between his heir and the Princess Isandre. Lionette de Trevelyan proposed that Solène draft orders to the Acadian ambassador, stamped with the Privy Seal, to string along the Caliph with false promises, until he ceded rights to the island of Cythera. It goes without saying that it was Lionette de Trevelyan's plan that these orders be discovered, destroying all hope of an Arcadian alliance. Solène Belfort was a secretary of the Privy Seal. She had access and could do it, though it was high treason to falsify royal orders. I felt the wind of her pacing and her crops swishing as she struck it absent-mindedly against her boot. "What does your mistress offer?" she asked the courier. A deep voice answered,
"A title in Azal, my lady. The county of Vichard, with 200 men-at-arms and an income of 40,000 ducats annual."
The crop swished again. I saw it out of the corner of my eye. "Tell her I'll take it," Solène Belfort said decisively. "But I want the title in hand before the orders go out, and safe passage guaranteed to Azal." Even at a distance I could sense her cold smile. "Tell her I want no less an escort than Prince Baudouin and his glory-seekers. Let us see if she is in earnest." From the rustle and creak I knew the courier bowed.
"As you wish, my lady. Title in hand and Prince Baudouin as escort. I will relay your words."
"Good." Sometime after the courier had left, I felt her gaze upon me. It lingered for a moment before I looked up. She was smiling, swinging her crop in great looping circles. My skin shuddered involuntarily at the sight of it. "I'm of a mind to celebrate, Phaedra," she said with cheerful malice. "What a happy coincidence that you're here." As matters fell out, Lionette de Trevelyan declined Solène Belfort's counter-offer, and as the Marquise had foreseen, the sticking price was Prince Baudouin. Whatever the Lioness of Azal had planned, it was not worth risking her precious son. It soon transpired that the rumours of an alliance were no more than that, rumours. Isandre de la Courcelle would not wed the Caliph's son, and the island of Cythera remained firmly in Arcadian control. Nonetheless, Delaunay prized the information, for it revealed to him where the lines of communication lay, and shed some light upon the dim shape of Lionette de Trevelyan's ambition. Throughout it all, the name of Baudouin de Trevelyan continued to resound from the lips of peers of the realm. While the allies of Cumlach disbanded, returning to their homes and posting lighter guards on the border, Baudouin and his glory-seekers rode the length of Cumlach, armed with a special dispensation from the king. They put the fear of Elowa into Scaldic raiders, and not a few Dangeline mountain villagers, who bore the cost of putting up his riotous crew, taken out in food stores and eligible maidens. At court, Baudouin continued to evade a plethora of matrimonial snares, and despite the disapproval of his parents, continued to be seen with Melisande Charizai. It was rumoured that Lionette de Trevelyan had threatened to disown him if they wed, and I think there must be some truth to this, if only because of what would later come to pass. The Lioness of Azal did not make idle threats, and Melisande was clever enough to know which opponents could not be defeated face to face. Her I had seen only once since I began my service to Narmar, and that at one of Delaunay's gatherings, although I had thought of her often, you may be sure. In the courtyard she shone, no less for her beauty than her barbed wit. To me she was courteous and pleasant, but I encountered her in the hall on my way back from an errand to the kitchen, and her smile made my knees weak.
"Turn around," she murmured.
I did it without even thinking. Her fingers unbuttoned the back of my bodice as skillfully as an adept's. Indeed, I could have sworn the fabric yearned open at her mere touch. I felt her nails against my skin, tracing the base of my mark, following it upward. Her body radiated behind me, and I could smell the scent she used, subtle and spicy, mixed with the musk of her flesh.
"Your name is being spoken in certain circles, Phaedra."
Only the tips of her fingers touched me, but she was close enough that her breath was warm on my neck. The amusement in her voice reminded me of Delaunay. Nothing else did.
"You've never given the signal, have you?"
"No," I breathed the word, unable to summon the strength to speak it.
"I thought not."
Melisande Charizai laid her palm flat in the small of my back, where it burned like a brand, then drew it away and did up my buttons, quick and professional. I could hear her smile in the darkness.
"Some day we will see which throws truer, Kushiel's line or Kushiel's dart."
I dare say neither of us knew how true her words would prove, nor in what manner. Melisande knew full well what Delaunay was about with Alcuin and me, and knew, too, that I was bait for her interest. And she had every intention of taking it in her own time. My patrons were not known for their gifts of forbearance. I had learned patience and intrigue at Delaunay's knee, and I am not ashamed to say that the thought of a patron who could match it quite undid me. When I thought of Baudouin de Trevelyan now, it was with a measure of pity and envy. The Scaldy threat, at least, seemed quelled for the time being, or so popular court wisdom had it. Where the border lords of Cumlach were not, Baudouin and his glory-seekers were. Delaunay was not so sure. He entertained his old friend and teacher Gonzago de Escabares when he returned from an academic's pilgrimage to Tiberium. They spoke privately, no one but Alcuin and I in attendance.
"There are rumours, Antinous,"
the Aragonian historian said over the rim of his wineglass, looking like a wise satyr. There was that name again. My mark extended a full third of the way up my back, and yet I knew no more than before of the mystery of Delaunay. This time he ignored it.
"There are always rumours," he retorted, toying with the end of his braid. "Sometimes I think each city-state in the whole of Caerdica Unitas has its own parliament, expressly for the purpose of disseminating rumours. Which are these, maestro?"
Gonzago de Escabares reached for a canapé of goose liver and chives rolled in flatbread.
"These are delightful. I must have your cook note the recipe for mine."
He ate fastidiously, licking his fingers and wiping crumbs from his beard.
"They say the Skuldic tribes have found a leader," he said when he was done, "a Kinil Rú of their own."
After a moment of staring surprise, Delaunay gave his bark of laughter.
"Surely you jest. The Skuldi have never been so quiet in our lives, maestro." "Precisely."
The Aragonian devoured another canapé and held out his glass for Alcuin to refill.
"They have found a leader who thinks."
Delaunay was silent, thinking about the implications. The Skaldic tribes were numerous, more numerous than the tribes of Alba and Era, who had united to defeat the Tiberian army, the greatest military force the continent of Europa had ever seen. Islanded, isolated, and hemmed in for centuries by the master of the straits, the armies of the Kingdom of Alba had never constituted a true threat to our borders. A united Skaldic force would be another matter.
"What are they saying?" he asked at length.
Gonzago set down his wineglass.
"Not much yet, but you know there are always Skaldi among the mercenaries travelling the trade routes, yes? It began among them, a whisper, not even a rumour, of great doings in the north. Slowly traders began to notice that their numbers were changing steadily. Not more Skaldi, but different ones, changing places, replacing their numbers. Skaldi went, and Skaldi came.
"'It is hard to tell the difference,' he added, "'for they are wild and ungroomed to a man. "'But I spoke with a leather merchant in Milazza, "'who was certain that he detected a growing cunning "'among the Scaldi he hired to protect his caravan. "'I thought of the Scaldic tribesman "'who had taken me under his wing so long ago, "'a faded memory of a laughing moustached giant. "'There had been no cunning in him, and much kindness.' Alcuin sat wide-eyed on his couch. His memories of the Scaldi held only blood, iron, and fire.
"'He thought they were gathering information,' Delaunay said, tugging his braid restlessly as the wheels of his mind turned and processed. "'To what end?'
"'That I do not know,' Gonzago shrugged and nibbled at a canapé. "'But there is a name which is spoken around the Scaldi campfires in hushed tones.' Voldemar or Voldemar Selig. Voldemar the Blessed, who is proof against iron. And last summer, for a fortnight, there was nary a Scaldi to be found in Cedica Unitas, and it was rumoured that Voldemar Selig summoned a high council of the tribes of Scaldia somewhere in the old Helvetican holdings. I do not know if it is true, but my friend the leather merchant told me a friend of his who was close to the duchy in Milazza swore that the duke received an offer of marriage for his eldest daughter from a king Voldemar of Scaldia. Gonzago shrugged again and spread his open hands in an Aragonian gesture. What can one do with such rumours? My friend said the duke of Milazza laughed and sent the Scaldi envoy home with 7 cartloads of silk and fustian. But I tell you, I mistrust this quiet on the Scaldi borders.
Delaunay tapped his front teeth with the nail of one forefinger.
And meanwhile, Baudouin de Trevelyan gambles about the fringes of Cumlach, skewering starving brigands and garnering acclaim for protecting the realm. You are right, maestro. This bears watching. If you learn aught in your travels, send me word. You know I will, my dear.
Gonzago de Escabare's tone softened, and his brown eyes were kind in his homely face.
Do not think I am not ever mindful of your promise, Antinous.
I was still puzzling out this last convoluted sentence when Delaunay's sharp gaze fell upon Alcuin and myself. He clapped his hands briskly.
Fedra, Alcuin, to bed with the both of you. The maestro and I have much to discuss, and none of it needful for your ears.
It need not be said that we obeyed, but I will add that one of us, at least, went reluctantly. Chapter 19. Despite the concerns of Gonzago de Escabares, the only news of note that occurred outside our borders in the following months lay not within Scaldic territories, but in the kingdom of Alba. And the rumour that crossed the waters was this. The Cruach of Alba was dead, slain, it was said, by his own son, who sought to overturn the old matrilineal rites of succession and seize rulership of Alba for himself. The Cruach's rightful heir, his club-footed nephew, had fled with his mother and 3 younger sisters to the western shores of Alba, where the Dalriada of Era, who had a foothold there, gave them asylum. No one had ever paid much heed to the regency of Alba before, but because this Cruach had set foot on Dangeline soil, it merited a passing interest. In a joint venture with the royal house of Aragon, Quintilius Raus was ordered to bring his fleet through the southerly Cadishan Strait and scout the coastline. He reported that elder brother maintained his sovereignty over Alban waters. Thus Ganelon de la Courcelle strengthened his alliance with the King of Aragon, and Quintilius Raus found an excuse to leave a portion of his fleet on the coast of Cushith. At Delaunay's he boasted of his cunning, but I liked him well enough to forgive it. Delaunay was summoned twice to court, and afterwards said nothing of it. No word came from de Escabares, nor any rumour of Voldemar Selig. The borders of Cumlach remained quiet, so quiet that Prince Baudouin, grew bored of seeking glory in the mountains and began to divide his time between the royal court and his home in Azal. His father, the Duc de Trevelyan, was quarrelling with the king. Azal maintained a small but capable fleet of its own, and the Duke was put out that the king had called upon Quintilius Rous to scout the coastline instead of him. There was some merit to his grievance, for Azal lay almost in hailing distance of Alba, whereas Quintilius had needed to bring his fleet a fortnight's journey around Aragonia. That the joint venture strengthened ties with the House of Aragon, Duke Mark knew full well. But Quintilius Rous was not of royal blood, and the slight stung. I do not know if the king mistrusted the Duc de Trevelyan on this score. I do know that he mistrusted his sister, and her all-too-obvious ambition for her son, and was too canny to pass up a means of undermining her power when there was political gain to be had in the process. All of these things I heard and knew. Indeed, de Launay and Gaspard Trevelyan had a falling out over the quarrel between House Courcelles and Trevelyan, but during this time they registered lightly on my consciousness. I was young and beautiful, and I chose my patrons from among the scions of Eloa. I would be lying if I said all of this did not go to my head. There is a power in being able to choose one's own patrons, and I learned to wield it well. 3 times running I declined offers from Lord Childeric d'Essomme, until even de Launay debated the wisdom of my judgment. But in this I was the master of my art. When I acceded to his 4th offer, his final, his servant warned, his stored fury was prodigious indeed. That was the night he burned me with a red-hot poker. It was also the night he let slip his patron's name. Servants of Narmar are not the only ones with patrons, of course. In court society, nearly everyone is either a patron or patronized. It is only the services which differ. One of the reasons I loved de Launay so well was that he was one of the very few people I ever met who truly stood free of the system. I suppose it is one of the reasons d'Essomme hated him so. The other reason came clear with the name he so carelessly uttered. Always, without exception, it pleased Childeric d'Essomme to press me to reveal de Launay's motives. Where Solène Belfort sought a myriad of reasons to punish me, d'Essomme needed only the one, de Launay. When he used the poker, he knew he had gone too far. For my part, I sagged in my bonds, splayed against the X-shaped cross he so favoured, fighting to remain conscious, and thinking how de Launay would berate me for failing to give the signal. In truth, I hadn't thought he would do it. But d'Essomme had laid the poker against the inside of my thigh, and the stench of my own scorched flesh surrounded me. The poker had stuck when he pulled it loose, tearing skin. There was no pleasure in this, at least not in the way that anyone but an anguissette would understand it. Pain strung my body like a plucked harp-string, and behind closed eyes my vision was washed in red. I was in it and of it, at once the taut quivering string and the high sustained note of it, a note of purest beauty uttered in the depths of torment. In a crimson haze I heard, as if from a great distance, d'Essomme's agitated voice and felt his hands patting my cheeks. Somewhere I could hear the echoes of a great clangor, and knew he had thrown the poker from him in horror.
"Phaedra, Phaedra, speak to me! Oh, for blessed Eloa's sake, speak to me, child!"
There was anxiety in his tone, and caring, more than he ever would have confessed. I felt his hands patting me, chafing rough tenderness, and heard his mutter,
"Bacchia Lomver will have my head for this, if de Launay makes a charge. Phaedra, child, wake up! Tell me you're well. 'Tis naught but a burn."
Head hanging, I opened my eyes, and the wash of red receded, fading from my right eye and dwindling to a mote in my left. Seeing my lashes lift, Childeric d'Essomme gave a cry of relief, undoing my bonds and easing my limp body down as it slipped loose of the whipping cross. Cradling me in his arms in the middle of his trophy room, he shouted for his physician.
I knew then that he was mine. As I had guessed, Delaunay was not so pleased, though he withheld comment upon my return. He ordered me confined to bed and brought in a Yeshuite doctor to attend me. Although they are shunned in many nations, they are made welcome in Terre d'Ange, for blessed Eloah was fathered by the blood of Yeshua, which we do not forget. The doctor cut a solemn figure with his grave face and the long curling sidelocks of his people, but his touch was gentle, and I rested more comfortably when he had applied a poultice to draw the poisons and rebandaged my thigh. It discomforted him to touch me in so intimate a fashion, which made me smile.
"I will come in 2 days to examine her," he said to Delaunay in his formal accented d'Angeline. "But I bid you inspect the wound on the morrow, and if there is an odour of mortification, send for me without delay."
Delaunay nodded and thanked him, waiting courteously until the doctor was ushered from my room. Then he turned his dry look on me and raised his eyebrows.
"I hope it was worth it," he said curtly.
I did not take offence, for I knew it was only that he cared for me. "You may be the judge, my lord." I squirmed in my bed, rearranging pillows to sit propped, until Delaunay swore softly and aided me, his careful movements at odds with his tone.
"All right," he said,
unable to prevent a gleam of amusement from lighting his eye at my dissembling. "There is a pile of love gifts from Childeric de Somme amassing in the hallway in atonement for his injury, and if he doesn't stop soon, next it will be a brace of oxen or a copy of the lost book of Raziel itself. Now what information do you have that is so valuable it is worth turning yourself into a braised rack of lamb?" Content to have his full regard, free of judgment, I relaxed against my cushions and gave it straight out. "Childeric de Somme answers to Barquiel l'Envers." To watch Delaunay's face at such a time was like watching a storm cross the horizon. Duke Barquiel l'Envers was full brother to the long-dead Isabel.
"So de Somme is the conduit for House Envers' ambitions," he mused aloud. "I wonder who kept the torture light. He must be behind l'Envers' posting to the Caliphate. You told him nothing."
His glance was swift and cutting. "My lord," I protested, sitting upright and wincing at the pain.
"Phaedra, I'm sorry."
Delaunay's face changed as he knelt at my bedside and grasped my hand.
"This information you give me is a pearl of great price, truly, but it is not worth the pain you have suffered for it. Promise me that next time you will give the signal."
"My lord, I am what I am, and it is for that you bought my mark," I said reasonably. "But I did not think he would use the poker, truly." Seeing him take ease from my words, I pressed the moment's advantage. "My lord, who was Isabel l'Envers to you, that her enmity should pursue you beyond the grave?" If I thought to catch him in a weak moment, I was mistaken. His features took on their stern look, which I loved.
"Phaedra, we have spoken of this, and it is best you do not know why I do as I do. Mark my words, if Childeric de Somme truly thought you knew aught you were not telling, he would not be so gentle with you, and his gentleness leaves little to commend it."
And with that he kissed my brow and took his leave, bidding me to sleep and be healed. Happily I have good healing flesh, legacy of Cushiel's dart. When the Yeshuite doctor returned, he pronounced the ugly burn clean of any trace of festering, and gave Delaunay a salve to spread on it that would aid the growth of new skin and help to prevent scarring. I saw adepts in Valerian House whose skin was thick with welted scars, but that was never the case with me. Delaunay always kept in stock a supply of unguents and balms to spread on such weals as I received, though I may say that none ever worked so well as the Yeshuite salve. Since I could not practice my art, I spent time with Hyacinth. Even as my station had changed, so had his. He had at long last convinced his mother to part with some of her hard-won gold to augment his own, and they now owned the building on Rue Coupole.
It was no less small and squalid than before, but it was theirs. They lived, as they always had, on the lower floor, and let rooms to an interminable stream of Tsingani families who passed through the city with every horse fair and circus that followed the trade routes. His mother had grown older and dwindled in size, but the fierce glare of her deep-set eyes had not diminished. I marked how the itinerant Tsingani paid her respect, and I marked how they avoided Hyacinth, though I never spoke of it to him. Among the Tsingani, he was half d'Angeline and shunned, but among d'Angelines he was the prince of travellers, and the denizens of Monui continued to pay good coin to have him read their palms. For his part, Hyacinth had not given up his dream of finding his mother's people and claiming his birthright as her son. But these were not such Tsingani as passed the city's boundaries and came to dwell for a time within it. They had done so once, and once only, he told me, for so his mother had told him, and lost their fairest daughter to the wiles of d'Angeline's seduction. Now only the poorest of companies entered the city gates, while the flower of Tsingani nobility wandered the earth following the Lungo Drome, the long road. So Hyacinth believed, and it was not for me to disabuse him of this notion. Perhaps, indeed, it was true. For now he seemed well enough satisfied to remain the undisputed prince of travellers in Monui, and I was glad of it, for he was my friend. I never told him, though, that I had chosen his name as my signal. I loved Hyacinth dearly, but he would have crowed like a cock to hear it, and I could not abide that much of his vanity all of a piece. "So Childeric de Somme is in the Lanvers' pocket," he said when I told him my news, and whistled through his teeth. "That is news, Phaedra. What does your de Launay make of it?" "Nothing," I made a sour face. "He gets closer-lipped with age, and would fain protect us with ignorance. Though I think sometimes he tells Alcuin things he would not have me hear." We sat at the kitchen table, and I had thrown off my sangoir cloak, which I wore everywhere those days, for the air was stifling and smelled of cooking cabbage. His mother poked and muttered at the stove, ignoring us. It was a reassuring constant in my life. Hyacinth grinned at me and tossed a silver coin in the air, catching it in one hand and making it walk across his knuckles, then disappear. He had learned the trick from a street-corner illusionist in exchange for 2 weeks' lodging. "You are jealous." "No," I said, then, "yes, perhaps."
"Has he bedded the boy?"
"No," I exclaimed, offended at both the notion and his use of the word boy, when Alcuin was no younger than he himself. "De Launay would not do that." Hyacinth shrugged.
"Still, you must consider the possibility. You would be quick enough to boast of it if it were you."
"It's not me." The lack of promise in that outlook made me glum. "No, he is freer with Alcuin because he reckons Alcuin's patrons are not so dangerous as mine, or at least more subtle in the ways of violence. Anyway, they have been thick in politics since the day he took Alcuin to court to pose as his scribe. I do not see the logic in it, when the Cruach was slain and another rules in his place." Hyacinth's mother muttered louder at the stove. Once he had ignored such ominous rumblings. Now I noted his expression grew sharp, like a hound on the trail of scent. "What is it, mother?" The words were repeated, unintelligible. Then turning, she brandished a ladle at us. I remembered her pointing finger, which had struck a note of fear in my heart.
"Pray heed," she said in a dire tone. "Do not discount the Kullock, Godim."
I looked at Hyacinth, who blinked. "I do not understand your words," he said carefully to his mother. She trembled and lowered the ladle, passing her other hand before her eyes. Her face looked sunken and old.
"I know not," she admitted in a thready voice.
"The black boar," I cleared my throat, feeling strangely apologetic. Both of them glanced at me. "It is Cruinia, madam, the words you spoke. I had been so long dissembling among patrons, I was awkward in vaunting my learning. "Do not discount the black boar."
"Well, then," her expression cleared, resuming its usual dour mien. Her jaw jutted forward obstinately, defying me and my knowledge and my sanguine cloak to contradict her.
"There you have it, missy. Do not discount the black boar."
It was my second such prophecy granted free of charge by the mother of the Prince of Travellers and my one true friend, and as clear as the first had been, the second was oblique. I looked once more at Hyacinth, who raised both hands and spread them, shaking his head. Whatever the black boar might be, he knew no better than I. When I returned home, I related the incident to Delaunay, who had spent the day being fitted for a new suit of clothing. As he misliked wasting over much time on tailors, he was in a foul mood and quick to dismiss the warning.
"You of all people should know that Singani fortune-telling is mere foolery," he said sharply.
I stared at Delaunay. "She has the gift. I have seen it. My lord, she did not seek to lie in this, nor before, when she told me I would rue the day I unravelled your mystery."
"She..." Delaunay stopped. "She said that?"
"Yes, my lord."
Alcuin brought the wine-jug over to refill Delaunay's glass. His hair fell forward as he bent to his task, and Delaunay ran a shining strand of it through his fingers absent-mindedly, gazing at the flame of an oil lamp.
"My lord," Alcuin said softly, straightening, "you remember I told you of the whispers of the Alban delegation? The Cruach's sister had a vision of a silver swan and a black boar."
"But who is—"
Delaunay's face changed.
"Alcuin, send word on the morrow to Telesis de Mornay. Tell her I would speak with her."
"As you wish, my lord."
Chapter 20. What became of that conversation I never learned, or at least not until much later, when it mattered no longer. I might have been put out at it, were it not for the fact that my own interests, for a time, outweighed Delaunay's intrigues. Melisande Charizai was giving a birthday party for Prince Baudouin de Trevelyan. She had engaged the whole of Sirius House for an entire night to do it, and we were invited, all three of us. I had not forgotten the promise she had made me when last we met. I had not forgotten her words when first I met her. "You do wish to serve Nama, don't you, child?" No matter how many patrons I had had, none of them had ever turned my knees to water with a glance. If I have not said it, Melisande was exceedingly wealthy. House Charizai is prosperous to start, and she had at her disposal as well the estates of two deceased husbands. Indeed, if not for the rumours that surrounded those deaths, it is conceivable that Lionette de Trevelyan would have found Melisande a suitable daughter-in-law, although I doubt it. From what I had heard, she did not strike me as a woman capable of tolerating rivalry among equals. For my part, I do not believe Melisande Charizai killed either of her husbands. Both were very rich and very old, and I do not think she had need, although she was only 16 the first time, and 19 at her second wedding. I would fain believe she was no less calculating then than when first I encountered her, and the woman I knew was far too clever to take an unnecessary risk for mere gold. Although I didn't know then how skilled she was at using the hands of others to meet her own ends, I know it now. Whatever the truth of the matter, it left her a very rich woman, and the city was fair buzzing with the news of Baudouin's birthday party. Invitations written in gold ink on thick vellum and scented with fragrance were delivered and jealously guarded. Rumours abounded regarding the list of invitees and the possible slights that lay behind omissions. Melisande delivered the invitation herself, sweeping into the house in a cloud of the same subtle fragrance that impregnated the card. Delaunay opened it and raised his eyebrows.
"All of my household?" he inquired dryly. "You do realize, I trust, that my protégés are not included in the contract fee for Sirius House, Melisande."
She tossed her chin and laughed, showing the lovely line of her throat.
I knew you would say that, Anarfiel. That's why I came to make the invitation in person. Yes, of course. This is my party, after all, and your little pupils are more interesting than any three courtiers together. I thought it was Baudouin's party. His gibe made no mark. She merely looked at him through her lashes and smiled. It is for Baudouin, of course, but it is my party, Anarfiel. Surely you know me well enough for that.
Delaunay returned her smile, running the ball of his thumb over the edge of the vellum.
If you think to win the son of the Lioness of Azal over to defying his mother, you may be overstepping your bounds, Melisande. She makes a fearsome enemy.
Ah, my dear Delaunay, always fishing for knowledge, she said lightly, putting her hand over his and taking hold of the card of invitation. If you do not wish to attend.
No.
Shaking his head, he grinned and took a step back, retaining possession of the card.
We will be there. You may be sure of it.
I am overjoyed to hear it. Melisande Shahrazai made him a mocking curtsy and turned to leave. Catching sight of me standing in the shadows, she blew me a kiss as she made her exit. Delaunay saw me and frowned. What expression I wore, I cannot imagine.
Whatever happens, he said, you are to keep your eyes and ears open, Fedra, and warn Alcuin, too. Melisande Shahrazai does nothing without reason, and I cannot fathom her motive in this. It inclines me to suspicion.
A shadow crossed his face.
I suppose this means I must send for the tailor again, he added, annoyed at the prospect.
Annoyed or no, Delaunay ensured that all of us would cut a good figure at Baudouin's party. With his exquisite taste, it was a marvel how he had no patience for the process of fine attire, but the end result, you may be sure, was no less splendid for it. When all was done, Alcuin was resplendent in midnight blue velvet, a colour that made him look like a vision dreamt by moonlight. Delaunay wore the deep umber that made him look like an autumn feast, with his russet hair and saffron slashes in his sleeves, and I was delighted to find that he had commissioned another bolt of sanguin to have a gown made for me. Although it did not dip so low as I might have wished in the back, it is vulgar for a servant of Nama to display an unfinished mark. It had a low décolletage, and I wore a ruby pendant given me by Childeric de Somme that nestled in the hollow between my breasts. I had not returned to Sirius House since the day I had left it in Delaunay's coach, and it was strange to return. The first time aside, every time I had approached this place, it had been slung ignominiously across the pommel of a guard's saddle. Behind the closed gates, I could see that the house was ablaze with light and merriment. I shuddered as we drew up to the entrance, and Delaunay descended from the coach. "Are you all right?" Alcuin whispered, leaning over to grasp my hand. There was nothing but sweet concern on his face, and I repented of the number of times I had been jealous of him. "I'm fine," I squeezed his hand in reply, gathered my skirts, and followed Delaunay. Prince Baudouin de Trevelyan's natal festivities were already in full stride. It was summer, and nigh every door in the house was flung open. I, who had lived there 6 years, had never seen such a fete. Great vases of roses, heliotrope, and lavender were set on every surface, spilling an abundance of blossom and scent. In every niche musicians played, and it seemed lovers groped and sighed in every corner. A knight's fee had been paid for every adept in Sirius House. No guest would be refused. The thought of it staggered my mind and struck me with a wave of envious desire. To be in such a situation, bought for the night, available to anyone at the crook of a finger. I wished almost that I were an adept of Sirius House. And then I remembered that I was a guest, and my mind reeled further to think on it. We were conducted to the Great Hall, which was lit and adorned as I had only seen it for the midwinter mask. A throng of people in gorgeous plumage had already gathered, the sound of laughter and flirtation mingling with music, and 100 savoury odours wafting in the air. Beautiful apprentices of both sexes carried trays of food and drink, offering them to all and sundry. The liveried footman called out our names, and a handsome blond man in the colours of Sirius House extricated himself gracefully from the throng and came over to us.
"Fedra," he said, giving me the kiss of greeting. "Welcome. Welcome back."
It was Jareth Morin, a little older but much the same. I blinked in surprise, seeing that he wore a Darwain's chain about his neck with the seal of Sirius House upon it. He turned smiling to Delaunay.
"My Lord Delaunay, it is good to see you. Be welcome."
"And you are Alcuin no Delaunay?"
He grasped Alcuin's hand briefly, seeing a hint of reserve flicker in the dark eyes. I had forgotten the exquisite courtesies of the Night Court, or rather I had never been on the receiving end of them.
"Be welcome."
"The Dal—" I began to ask, then corrected myself. "The old Darwain." Jareth looked grave, although I could tell it was put on.
"She died some 7 years ago, Fedra. It was a peaceful death. She went in her sleep."
He touched his chain.
"I have been Darwain since."
"I am sorry," I murmured, unaccountably grieved. As fierce as the old woman had been, she was a part of my childhood. "You have been an able successor, I am sure."
"I do my best."
Jareth smiled gently.
"You remember Surya? She is my second now."
"Come," Delaunay said to Alcuin, nodding toward the interior of the great hall.
"Let us meet the revelers, my dear. I'm sure Fedra and the Darwain have much to discuss."
I watched them fade into the crowd. At the far end of the hall, a table was set on a dais for Prince Baudouin and a select few. Surya was there. The prince was feeding her tidbits by hand. Melisande Shara's eye looked amused. "She was the Winter Queen."
"It gave her a lot of status."
Jareth's voice changed, turning pragmatic, adept to adept.
"People still tell the story every midwinter. I'd have been a fool to choose anyone else."
He had never been a fool.
"No," I said, agreeing. "You made the right choice." Even from a distance, I could see that her pallid beauty had already peaked, and there was no evidence in her of the unexpected steel that lay beneath the delicate veneer of the few rare adepts who survived the loss of youth's tender bloom. I did not think Surya would live to make Darwain, and I felt sorry for her. She was always kind to me.
"I hope you have fond memories of Sirius House, Fedra."
Looking into Jareth's blue eyes, I realized it mattered to him. In certain circles my word could damage the reputation of his house. "Yes," I answered honestly. "If I never belonged, nor was I shunned, and what ill-treatment I received I well deserved, and," I smiled wickedly at him, "quite enjoyed." He blushed. It is a mark of delicacy in Sirius to find the stronger passions immodest.
"There is no finer training than that of Sirius House," I added.
"It has stood me in good stead, and I can only speak well of my time here."
"I am pleased," he said, recovering his aplomb
and making me a bow.
"We are honored to have fostered you."
Reaching into a pocket of his waistcoat, he drew forth a token of Sirius House.
"Please take this, and know you are always welcome here."
I took it and thanked him graciously. Jareth smiled.
"Enjoy the night," he said. "It is not often a servant of Narmar has a chance to be a patron."
With that he took his leave of me, moving smoothly on to greet newly arriving guests. Neither Delaunay nor Alcuin were in sight, but they would surely be making their way toward to the dais, and I hurried to join them. It would be inappropriate for a member of Delaunay's household to be absent when he paid his respects to the prince. I had not lost the trick of slipping gracefully through a crowd, and had to remind myself that there was no need to keep my gaze downcast. Still, I felt an unwarranted thrill of boldness as I looked other patrons full in the face. Strange indeed to be here again. A handful of people had gathered at the foot of the dais, waiting to wish the prince a joyous birthday, and there I found Delaunay and Alcuin. As always, there was a stillness to Delaunay's presence, an observant calm that lent him a dignity surpassing that of those who surrounded him. On the dais, anything but dignity reigned. Prince Baudouin, older than the wild boy whom I had first seen in this hall, had lost neither his good looks nor the hectic gleam of gaiety that lit his sea-grey eyes. As I had seen from the back of the hall, he held poor Surya on his lap, keeping her captive with one arm. Adepts of Sirius House are ill-suited to undignified treatment. If this was to be the nature of the fate, Melisande would have done better to reserve another house. Orchis, perhaps, or Jasmine. She sat at Baudouin's right hand, and I understood then that the adept's discomfort entertained her. Melisande's choice had been deliberate. Two of Baudouin's guard, high-ranking nobles' sons, were privileged to share his table. One, following the prince's lead, dandled a female adept on his lap. The other had a young boy standing attendant at his shoulder, refilling his wineglass.
"Well, well."
Baudouin lounged in his chair and regarded Delaunay from behind the burden of Surya, as our turn came to mount the dais.
"Messire Anarfiel Delaunay, I hope you've repaired your quarrel with my kinsman, the Comte de Forcay. He has so few friends, after all. Come, what have you brought me? A charming pair of bed-servants."
"My prince will have his chest."
Delaunay bowed smoothly, and behind him Alcuin and I followed suit.
"Alcuin and Phaedra know Delaunay, of my household. Please accept our most sincere wishes for a joyous natality."
He turned to Alcuin, who held up the prince's gift. A filigree silver pomander, containing a fragrant lump of amber. Delaunay took it from Alcuin and presented it to the prince with another bow.
"Nice."
Baudouin took the pomander and sniffed it, then shook it next to Surya's ear. A hidden bell tinkled sweetly.
"Very nice. You have leave to enjoy my party, Anarfiel. You and your little playmates. I swear it, my mother spoke truly of you. Only you would bring whores to a pleasure house, Messiah."
Delaunay's expression never altered, but Alcuin flushed, the rising tide of blood clearly visible beneath his fair skin. At that moment, one of the prince's guards, the unencumbered one, exclaimed,
"I know that one! Look at the eyes on her. That's Delaunay's Anguissette, the one as likes being hurt."
Drawing the sword he carried for the prince's protection, he lodged the tip of it under the skirts of my gown and began to raise them.
"Come then, let's have a look," he said, laughing.
Baudouin's interest was piqued. He pushed Surya to one side and leaned forward to look. I never even saw Delaunay move. It was that swift. There was the ringing of steel striking stone, and the guard wrung his empty, stinging hand, his blade trapped flat on the floor beneath Delaunay's boot. His face was dangerous as he locked eyes with Baudouin.
"My lord, may I remind you that these members of my household are your guests, here by invitation of your lady."
"Phaedra?" Surya whispered, coming around the table to take my face in her hands. "It is you. Blessed Nama, but you've prospered, child." Still seated, Baudouin waved his hand negligently.
All right, Delaunay. Your point is made. Give Martin back his sword. Lads, with all of Sirius House at your disposal, I hardly think we need trouble Messiah Delaunay over his playmates."
Despite his casual manner, he truly did have a measure of command. And he was, after all, a prince of the blood. Delaunay picked up the guard's sword and handed it over with a stiff bow, which Martin returned, sheathing his sword and sitting. Everyone remained silent as Baudouin raised his glass and drained it. Setting it down with a bang, he eyed me thoughtfully, his gaze taking in the scarlet fleck in my eye and wandering over my body, clad in close-fitting sanglois velvet, as if offered for his delection. This time I blushed. "A true Anguissette, he mused. Melisande Charizai leaned over and whispered in his ear. Listening, he raised his eyebrows, smiled, then lifted her hand and kissed it passionately, looking into her sapphire eyes with nigh-doting affection.
"You are without peer," he murmured to her, and waved his hand again in our general direction. "If you would serve my will, go now, and make merry. Your prince commands it."
"Yes, my lord,"
De Launay said dryly, motioning us to precede him. His tone was wasted on Baudouin, but I caught a gleam of amusement on Melisande's face as she watched us go. Unnerved by the encounter, I let myself become isolated in the crowd and accepted a glass of cordial from a pretty fosterling. I drank it at a gulp, setting the glass back on the tray. I had not eaten, and the cordial burned sweetly down my throat. The girl stood in obedient attendance, just as I had. She was perhaps 13, near to the age of taking her vows. Fair-haired and delicate, a true night-blooming flower. I touched her cheek and felt her shudder. This was what it was to be a patron, to have that power. I was discomfited by it and moved away, feeling her lifted gaze at my back, wondering. De Launay had ordered us to watch and listen, but I was hard put to concentrate. I moved among the crowds, pausing to converse here or there, trying to discern the patterns beneath the merriment, but my veins were afire with the cordial I had drunk, and the music and candles and scent of flowers made my head swim. Prince Baudouin's friends and supporters abounded, declaring in carelessly loud tones that they should call for a public referendum, that the king should appoint Baudouin his successor, that Parliament should intervene. None of the talk was new, and none seemed more urgent nor serious than it had a year ago. Growing weary of circulating, and wishing to avoid the advances of a certain persistent chevalier who was plaguing me to dance with him, I slipped out of the great hall and made my way to a seldom-used pleasure niche on the first floor that had served as a refuge sometimes in my childhood. A flicker of lamplight and a man's beseeching voice stopped me before entering. I drew back into the shadows.
"I have sent word to you 5 times. How can you be so cruel to refuse me?"
There was desperation in the tone, and I knew the voice. It was Vital Bouvard. Alcuin's voice, cool and distant. "Sir, I did not think to see you here. You are not known to be a friend of Prince Baudouin's."
"Nor am I known to be an enemy."
After the alarm in Vital Bouvard's voice, there was a pause.
"The Lady Charizai pays for information on the Stregardza, and the Stregardza pay for talk of House Trevelyan. Where is the harm in it? I am a trader, sweet boy."
His tone turned wheedling.
"Why will you not deign to ply your trade?"
I heard a rustle and a scraping sound. Alcuin had shaken off his touch.
"I am a servant of Nama, not a galley slave, sir. 7 times I have agreed to your contract, and 7 times you have stinted your offering."
Another pause.
"I will make you a patron gift."
Bouvard's voice trembled.
"Any amount you name, only say it."
Alcuin drew a deep breath, and his voice turned ardent as he answered.
"Enough to make my mark, and the answer to De Launay's question. That is my price, sir."
At this, even I caught my breath sharply. There was a long silence, and then Bouvard spoke again.
"You ask too much," he said dully.
"It is my price."
There was adamant in the words. I was astonished at the depth of feeling in him. I had known from the beginning that he had no love for this work. I had not known until then how much he despised it. And if he had hidden it from me, how much better had he hidden it from De Launay? Well, indeed, I think, for De Launay would never have permitted Alcuin to continue in the service of Narmar had he known. Not only was it against his nature, but blasphemous as well.
"And if I pay it,"
Bouvard was saying, the tremor back in his voice,
"I will see you no more."
"If you pay it," Alcuin said softly, "you will see me once more, Messiah. If you do not, you will never see me again."
Another long silence, then once more Bouvard.
"It is too much," he said, repeating himself. "I will think on it."
Alcuin made no reply.
I heard the swish of cloth as Bouvard turned to leave and retreated further into the darkness, not wanting to be seen. There was not much risk of it, as he had the look of a man much distracted as he hurried past me. When Alcuin didn't emerge, I stole forward to steal a glance. There was a small statue of Narmar in the niche, before which he knelt. Lamplight flickered on the ghostly white of his hair as he gazed up at her.
"Forgive me, my lady goddess," I heard him murmur. "If I violate your precepts, it is only to obey those of our Lord Eloa. What I do for love."
It was enough. I did not want him to know I had witnessed it. Adepts of Sirius House and pupils of Anafiel Delaunay alike are taught to move without sound when need requires. I crept away in silence. Lovers clinched in the hallways and boudoirs, revelers danced and drank in the great hall, musicians played, apprentices served, and adepts offered pleasure. In all the gaiety, only I seemed to feel solitary and alone. As a child, I could not have imagined one might aspire any higher. To be a courtesan of such note that I might attend a fate such as this, before I had even made my mark. As the invited guest of a prince's mistress, it was more than ever I had dreamed, but my pleasure was tempered by too much knowledge. Knowledge of Delaunay's teaching, knowledge of Alcuin's despite for this world I knew so well. This world in which I had no place as patron or servant. I missed Hyacinth and wished he were here. I even wished the old Darwain were here. Driven by melancholy, I sought solace in one of the lesser gardens, thinking to be alone with my unaccustomed emotions and soothed by the moonlit play of water in the fountain. Even in this I failed, for the shadowed torches were lit and several others had found the garden already. In one dim corner, a knot of people writhed to the sound of giggles and moans. I tried to count their number by limbs and failed. 3 at least, but perhaps 4. Under an ornamental apple tree, another couple lay entwined. Since I had no place else to go, I sat by the fountain anyway, trailing my fingers in the rippling water, and wondering if the Darwain's ancient golden carp still lived. I felt a touch on the back, on my neck.
Phaedra.
I knew her voice. It sent a shiver of cold fire down my spine. I looked up to see Melisande Charizai smiling down upon me.
"Why are you here alone?" she asked. "Surely you would not disdain my hospitality."
I stood quickly, brushing off my skirts. "No, my lady."
"Good."
She was standing close enough that I could feel her warmth. It was too dark to see the blue of her eyes, but I could see the languorous sweep of her lashes.
"Do you know what they say in Cushith about sinners in Cushiel's charge?"
she asked, running the tip of one finger over my lower lip. I shook my head, dazed by her nearness.
"It is said that when offered the chance for repentance, they refused it for love of their lord."
With the same hand she undid my hair, letting it fall in a cascade.
"I believe I have found the perfect gift for Prince Baudouin tonight," she said casually, twining her hand in my hair.
"You." Jerking her grip tight, she brought me hard up against her and kissed me. I gasped when she released me and sat down hard on the rim of the fountain, unable to stand, the entire length of my body throbbing from the sudden contact with hers. She had bitten my lip, and I touched it with my tongue, wondering if she had drawn blood. Melisande laughed, the sound liquid in the moonlight.
"Unfortunately," she said lightly, "he is well occupied this night, and I have promised to join him. But I will speak with Delaunay on the morrow about making an arrangement for the prince. After all, I owe him a farewell gift."
Turning, she beckoned to the darkness behind her. A fair young man, cast in the canon of Sirius House, stepped forward in compliance.
"Jean-Louis," Melisande said, laying her hand on his chest, "Phaedra is my guest.
see that she is well pleased."
He bowed gracefully.
"Yes, my lady."
She patted his arm and took her leave of the garden. "Be gentle with her," she said over her shoulder, amusement in her voice. Much to my dismay, he was.
Chapter 21.
I do not know if either Alcuin or Delaunay availed themselves of Melisande's hospitality in the same fashion. I rather doubt it. Delaunay gave my dishevelled appearance a sidelong glance in the carriage ride home, but offered no comment. True to her word, Melisande Charizai sent a man around the next day, bearing an invitation to Delaunay to pay her a visit that evening. I busied myself throughout the day, and engaged in my too oft neglected studies in the latter hours, setting myself the task of translating a slim collection of Skaldic war chants, compiled by the younger son of a Tiberian statesman who had travelled extensively in his youth. Delaunay had a friend, a Cerdiki composer, who claimed that one could understand any culture through its songs. Thus I was still awake when Delaunay returned, finding me ensconced in the library, all diligence and ink-stains. He gave me that look that meant he saw through my subterfuge, and sighed, settling in his favourite chair.
"So you caught Baudouin's eye, did you? Melisande is minded to buy him a night with you."
I shrugged and corked the ink, wiping my quill on a bit of rag. "My lord, is it not advantageous? You know I am nothing if not circumspect."
"You are agreeable, then."
He held out his hand for the draught of